Welcome to this week's episode of Resisting the Dragon's Beast. Peter and I are here talking about the second to last chapter, and we're on page 193. We're going to be talking about, first of all, what about the clergy? So we can start right away, Peter, with kind of a hot button topic. So the first question I have is, before we get to the pastors, should the government serve as the arbiter of truth?
Oh boy.
Why or why not?
That's a good question. And I think I would respond by asking, you know, one of the more famous officials in all of Christendom of all time. We mentioned him in the Apostles' Creed, Pontius Pilate, that Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. And he asked, you know, what is truth? And I think to that degree, natural man, fallen, you know, every human being coming into this world as a fallen human being, natural humans have a limited grasp of human reason and a limited grasp of morality according to God's law. And so in that respect, the best government and the best laws are those that will reflect the morality that God has established in Scripture, that they will condemn as evil and as wrong what it is that God condemns as wrong. And for the most part, we see this reflected in a lot of law codes over time, that we see, you know, that a law code like the Code of Hammurabi mentions that stealing is wrong, or that if you are a builder of a house, that you have a moral, ethical, legal obligation to build a house that is structurally sound. And so the question of should the government be an arbiter of truth? No, because truth is not wishy-washy. Truth is not simply, you know, personal, relevant to only a particular time or place. That truth transcends time and space and place. And so in that regard, the best that the government can do is reflect the truth. And they can decide truth based on, they can announce what something is true or not true on the basis of the truth. But entrusting the truth to the hands of the government generally has not gone well, you know, not to harp on governments and because Americans, we tend to get in a lot of our hopes on government and elections and that sort of a thing. But realistically, I still appreciate the axiom that the best government is that which governs least. And in that regard, our American system really provides for a free market discussion of topics. And I think that is the venue for being able to make a proposal of this is true, and then to weigh out in public debate and discourse, to weigh out, you know, what is true, and not only what is true, but then how ought we to apply this truth. And the government, you know, I think they should reflect that, although they have, I don't know, that arbiter is quite the word that I would go for.
Yeah, a couple of things on that. Just before we started recording today, I was watching a reaction video by the comedian and conservative comedian J.P. Sears. I quote him in this chapter. And he was reacting to the Don Lemon interview of Elon Musk on X. And, you know, I'm a little bit dumber for having listened to this, one of the smartest men in the world, Elon Musk, and someone who is not very smart, and Don Lemon, trying to interview him. But I bring it up here because in that interview, Elon Musk was trying to get, Don Lemon was trying to get Elon Musk to say that he should be better as an arbiter of truth on X, formerly known as Twitter. And so to take away hate speech and so forth. And Elon Musk just over and over again kept saying that he does not have the right legally to suspend speech. And he kept using the imagery of putting your thumb on the scale. And, you know, he kept saying that this is censoring. And Don Lemon would say, you're not censoring, you're moderating. And Musk, who's pretty brilliant, he said, that's just another term of for censoring. And but I bring that up as an example because that's what government will do. They will change words to say, well, these things don't really really happen. And another example, this just happened this week, of AOC is up and they're grilling someone, and she made the claim, because she's interviewing a guy and questioning a guy who had said that President Biden had committed all kinds of illegal crimes. And she's asking, like, what? And he listed a whole bunch and he said, RICO. And she said, RICO is not a crime. RICO, that's not a crime. That's a category of crimes. The reason I saw that particular exchange was it was happened to be on X, because I was posting comments from my book onto X, and I only follow like two people on X, but you can always follow Resisting the Dragon's Beast on X, and it was not the B. And they had a picture of Trump like this with his hand underneath his chin, just thinking wisely, because he's been convicted and found guilty of a RICO case in New York City. And now one of these senators or Congress ladies, I forget what she is, from New York, is saying, well, RICO is, there's nothing illegal with RICO. And it's just more of the same of just government officials and the media who work together. They just change the terminology to make something sound true or something that's false appear that it's really is true.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm not familiar with RICO as such, and I try to avoid most politics on TV, but that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, another example happened just before we started recording. My associate Nathan said that he was trying to appease the AI, the robots, when they begin taking over the world, like in Terminator, that we have a little robot upstairs that cleans the carpet of the church, and it's named Rosie. And he said, well, I just don't want these robots to get mad at me someday. I want Rosie to remember I took care of her. And I said, it's an it. And he said, well, but it's a feminine name, her. I said, yeah, but it's still an it. No, it's just silly stuff, but that's one of the ways that the government and the media, our culture, try to influence the way we talk. That if we see someone say that is supposedly transgender, and then all the articles will refer to this man in woman's clothing with the feminine terms, she and her. And if they ever get us to do that, calling him by her, you know, Daniel by Daniela, and referring to him as she or her, then we are buying into that, like Elon Musk said in that interview with Don Lemon, the woke mind virus. And it's really the woke stuff that we're dealing with today is really just the graduation of the political correctness from 10, 20 plus years ago. That those people that grew up as teenagers and college students with the political correctness, it didn't get better, it got worse, and those people then became in charge, and then now that's the result is wokeness.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. And I guess together with that, a couple of comments, probably 10 years ago, maybe 12 by this point, was when the University of Toronto wanted to get Jordan Peterson in trouble for not using the preferred pronouns when students came to class. And even 10, 15 years ago, when we were in downtown Ottawa, and I visited, obviously, University of Ottawa for, you know, a couple of functions and just see what we could do for ministry over there. And if you want to register as a student, even then, you had 50 different options for your sexuality, like male, female, and I don't know how you come up with 50, but they did. And as well as an option of none of the above. And Jordan Peterson's comment to the University of Toronto was basically that if you require me to use a term that does not align with objective reality, biological reality, then that is compelled speech, and you don't have the right to do that as my employer. And I guess together with that, when we're talking about terms, here's a good term. If you want to go down a Wikipedia rabbit hole, it's not too long for a rabbit hole. The term is Overton window, like over, T-O-N, Overton window. And you see this a lot in advertising. Once you're aware of the concept, you'll see it everywhere. The Overton window is basically the parameters that are set up. So what are the parameters? You think to yourself, I don't want to buy a car. I don't want to buy my teenager a car. And then the teenager is like, hey dad, here's this, $75,000, sports car. How about this one? This one looks great. And then all of a sudden, well, no, I'm not interested in buying you a $75,000 sports car. Well, okay. How about this one? This is only a $3,000 little beater. Okay. And what that child did was expand the window of your reasonable expectations. That's the Overton window, which is the set of expectations that if you're thinking, well, $3,000 car versus $8,000 car, then that $3,000 obviously wins out. But if you expand it to, oh, here's a $75,000 car, well, in comparison, even the $8,000 car is not a big deal. So advertisers use this to readjust and to reframe your expectations that you weren't, thinking of buying chips today, but you walked out with two extra bags because they were on sale, because they told you this is how much extra you get free, right? So the concept of Overton windows, when we're talking about terminology like this, the terminology leads the way and the concept follows along afterward. Like the terminology is the leash and the concept is the reality, the dog at the end of the leash. And in that sense, the terminology can pull the concept into our public consciousness as a way that is real and it's going to stay. And just to be aware of that, when somebody's like, well, is it respectful to use his or her, whatever name they're born with versus whatever name they want to go with? Obviously, you want to treat people with respect, but you also want to confess your faith in a way that reflects reality. It gets back to the question that there is an objective truth, and that no matter how deeply you care about this, how emotionally you feel about this, your feelings can't change that objective truth. And the objective truth that God has set up and the rules and the structure by which he's ordered the universe, it's going to have fallout in a person's life when that is denied and ignored.
Yeah, so a couple of things with that too. So Peter, you need to remember that Overton window. I think that's something we can talk about in the next book when we talk about compromise. I think that's a good way to, in an early chapter, to let people know, well, this has been being used on you. An example might be gay marriage. 10, 15 years ago, we would not talk about gay and marriage together. And you wouldn't refer to someone, a gay man, as a husband of someone else. But because, like you said, they've expanded things, and now we may talk about that and then explain things in those kinds of terms. But again, like we said with him and her, with the pronouns, is we are being brought into that mind virus. And, again, talking at the pronouns, I was thinking of my daughter, Belle, is graduating from high school pretty soon. And she declared for which college she's going to go to, a conservative Lutheran college. But it was really close between that and a public university. We both liked this public university. But the tipping point, I told Belle, was that I just got an innocuous email from them. And in there, way at the bottom, the lady had signed her name and then with her pronouns, she, her. And I told her, I don't really want you going there, because I don't know how much of that wokeness is in that university, but there's going to be some. Whereas in this college she's going to, there won't be. One more thing too is, you mentioned, Peter, about going down the rabbit hole. one of the books I listened to last month, and surprisingly, I enjoyed it, was Watership Down. And if
Oh,
you've
yeah.
ever, have you read that?
Yeah, I read that one last year.
Okay.
Fantastic. Talk about a rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting as grown men to think about a book that's about rabbits. And it's really, I think, very interesting. And the audiobook I listened to, the introduction, what made me really want to listen to and enjoy it was the fact that it was a dad who wrote the book, but he would read a lot of books to his children, and they were going on a 100-mile trip. And so they asked, his children asked him to create a story while he was driving, and created this whole elaborate tale of these rabbits and so forth. And then later on, the introduction said that he would read other stories at night to his kids, and they were bad. So they said, tell us that other story again. And then they told him to write it down. He wrote it down. He brought it back to them as kids, and they helped him edit it and so forth. But yeah, it's a really, I think it's an interesting book. I really enjoyed that one. I'm really not enjoying listening to the Three Musketeers. Oh man, this is 22 hours. I still have 6.5 hours to go. It's just,
Oh man.
I don't know.
That's
Anyhow,
funny.
that's just,
yeah, if you're gonna like Watership Down, then I always suggest one of the books that it was roughly based on, called The Iliad, by a guy named Homer, either written by Homer or by somebody named Homer, or The Odyssey, which is kind of, you know, the lesser of the two. But yeah, Watership Down, when he's talking about it, it brings up, picks up on a lot of those literary elements that the Greek epics and the Aeneid by Virgil would also bring in, the sense of superstition, the sense of purpose, getting you to question, you know, bigger questions about life and love. So I would say, you know, that would be a recommendation for our reading recommendation this week.
There you
unanimous.
Go. Well, you know, I did listen to The Odyssey last year. I'll put it up. I do have on my reading list The Iliad, but in between, I'm listening or I'm reading the Percy Jackson books. So that's kind of all about the Greek gods as well. So he's a half blood, but yeah. Now let's get to this question about the pastors. So, Peter, what do you think? Pastors and prophets called out their government leaders in Scripture. So did pastors throughout history. Could or should pastors today join the chorus in calling out their government leaders? What do you think?
Yes. Yeah, and the question of when did this stop? It's probably one of those things that changes gradually over time, and then it changes very quickly. And especially when you're thinking about the longevity of a pastor, is, you know, maybe you have 40 years as a pastor. Maybe, you know, like we celebrated the 50th anniversary in the ministry for a local pastor. You know, that was just, I don't know, 2 years ago, and he's still doing ministry, still enjoys it, not completely full time, but generally speaking, you know, 40 years is about it. And when we're talking about that amendment that talks about pastors endorsing one candidate or another, that was about 70 years ago. And so at best, that was two generations of pastors ago. That and you kind of overlap that even more. It's maybe three or four generations in any particular congregation. And so I think in that regard, things change very slowly until they change very quickly. And I would have to go back and look at history a little bit more to see to what extent churches were active in local politics. Although, you know, the paper that you referred to a while back, The War to End All Lutherans, really talked about the Wisconsin Synod and the Missouri Synod being very vocal and very active in endorsing a particular platform or party or candidate in local areas, because that candidate would allow them to continue teaching their children in the language of their choice. And so if I were to draw the line down, I would, go back to this boogeyman of, oh no, we're going to lose our tax exempt status. And then you just let that soak into the fabric of society for 70 years. And then all of a sudden, well, Pastor, you can't talk about that. That's political. Not from, you shouldn't be endorsing a particular candidate, to now, you can't talk about anything that is political because we don't know how to talk in a free speech society, and you don't want to offend anybody. And oh, by the way, the IRS is going to have some repercussions for you.
Yeah. And we keep coming back to this phrase because we hear it so often. The pastor should not be political. And my argument to that is the truth is never political. Okay. You can write that one down. That's for the next book. The truth is never political. And I say this numerous times in the book, is that the problem is, I think, like you said, with 70 years, that we have allowed things to become political because we didn't talk about them when they were cultural. And before they became cultural, they were moral. And before they're moral, they're therefore scriptural. And so we should be talking about the roles of men and women. And so we can talk about marriage. We should be talking about that there are, God created man and woman, and so there are only two sexes. I try and refrain from using the term gender, because that's part of that whole thing too of changing the languages of sex and gender.
Yeah. Because we're not Gnostics.
Yeah.
Like 1 John, there's no division between who you are internally in your spirit and who you are bodily in your body. And John was dealing with that at the end of the first century, and we're dealing with it again at the beginning of the 21st century. This idea that who I am in my heart or in my feeling is different from who I am when I, see myself in the mirror.
You're right.
I'll cut that one down too.
Well, that's the thing, is what I want the second book to be about is really talking about all of this, the paganism. That we see in the Old Testament, we see it today, and we're going to not compromise with any of that. But in the New Testament, it's not so much the paganism, it's the Gnosticism. I think that's another good one to talk about, of trying to separate the mind from the body. And we don't do that. On a side note, because we're doing lots of side notes here, I walked into the preschool today to read to them, and one of the students had asked—
Is it Dr. Seuss again?
It was not. I read a book called The Hippopotamus Ate the Teacher. But one of the preschoolers asked, when we die, do we fly to heaven? And I asked him, well, I don't know. Do we die and then do we get in an airplane? No. Do we get in a helicopter? No. How about a rocket ship? No. And then I corrected the false theology that probably many of their parents believe. I said, and we don't get wings and become angels. And I talked about the separation of the soul from the body. So the soul goes to be with the Lord, whether that's up or wherever. But then later on Judgment Day, our body does rise to meet our souls, to be with the Lord in the air. I said, the Apostle Paul says to the Christians in Thessalonica. And that's the part where we're separate, body and soul. But even right now, we're divided, but not separating mind from body like the people want to do today with transgenderism, which is still an ancient pagan theology of the Gnosticism of the first century and so forth. And that's where I always say, too, the devil is not very creative. He's like a one-trick pony. He just uses that same thing over and over again. And that same question is always, did God really say this? Mm-hmm. And so what we need to say is, this is what God says. This is what God says about protecting life. That's not political. That's when we talk about abortion or euthanasia, that's talking life issues. When you're teaching Sixth Commandment issues, that's not political about homosexuality. That's saying God created man and woman. And everything that is often termed as political, it goes back to what I said about it's, first of all, moral, and before that, it's scriptural.
Yeah, and if the church shouldn't talk about politics, then at the same time, then the state shouldn't rule on ethics or matters of faith.
There you go.
Like, let's be fair here. That if churches are not should not be talking about things, you know, that are talked about in the political sphere, let's look at first of all what is being talked about in the political sphere. And oh, by the way, they shouldn't be ruling on anything of ethics anyway, especially if they can't make a rational, reasonable scientific argument for it. Like, restrict them to the boundaries and the tool of human reason and see how far they get.
Yeah. And a part of this too is that pastors, we should be fulfilling our vocation as citizens. And part of a vocation as a Christian citizen is to be able to say right and wrong. Just because we get in the pulpit doesn't mean, well, now we're not going to call out these leaders. Now, we may not call them out by name from the pulpit, but I'm very open in Bible study of saying, hey, this is what I see this leader doing that's wrong. This is what I see this leader doing that's right. And part of this too, we talked about the two kingdoms a number of times, is I think when pastors say that we shouldn't be political, they're divorcing us from the left-hand kingdom, the kingdom of this world, and only living in the right-hand kingdom. That the right-hand and left-hand kingdoms, we live in them simultaneously. That we talk about a separation of the two kingdoms. And I don't know, Peter, if that's really Lutheran, the separation of the two kingdoms. I think it's better a distinction of the two kingdoms. Yeah. Just like we get into all kinds of false theology when we do a separation of Jesus as God and man. We're getting ready to be in Holy Week, and we can get into some pretty false theology when we say, well, Jesus was questioning God in the Garden of Gethsemane according to his human nature. Do I really have to go through this? And then according to his divine nature, that he, not my will, but yours be done. No, he's asking that question and making that statement as the God-man 100%. And we should be making decisions because we are living as Christian citizens in both kingdoms at the same time.
So are you saying there's some sort of hypostatic union between the Christian and the citizen within the clergy, at least?
Yeah, if you want to explain what that is.
No, I don't. So here's my question then. But you're talking about, you know, pastors saying, well, I don't want to talk about that because that's politics and I'm just a pastor right now. And the separation between Christian and citizen, or between clergy and citizenship. And I would say it is a subtle form of Lutheran Gnosticism, if that's a good word for it. That we generalize it a little bit. And whether you see it saying, like, me as a pastor, me as a Christian, that I have no concern about any of the issues that are on the docket, that even though I pay taxes, I have no vested interest in voting on whether a particular tax should be added on or not, or whether that money will be going toward a purpose that I want it to go toward. Like, you know, we had our primary election here in Ohio earlier this week, and on the ballot, in addition to the primary election, there were three local taxes that they've been talking about adding on, and do we want to add these on? And so by that logic, the pastor shouldn't vote according to taxes. But I think it's more than that, because I'd have to think about this a little bit more. But if we call it some, you know, subtle form of Lutheran Gnosticism that separates your Christianity from your citizenship as though they are completely separate, even though in reality they are not, we kind of see that same sense of Lutheran Gnosticism when it comes to your personal health. I have talked about this one. I won't apologize for it. That how many pastors are like, you know, I have a desk job. It back in the 60s, it became a white collar job, a lot less walking, a lot more sitting, and you know, sound mind, and I'm just a Christian, but you know, I'm 30, 40, 50 pounds over fat. as though that is acceptable, that is fine, because I am so utterly devoted to my spiritual life that I don't have time for the lesser, more vulgar things such as riding my bike or working out in the weight room, because there's some sort of a division, because, you know, the practices of my body, the practices of my eating, binging late into the night when I should be going to sleep, that doesn't affect my faith and my religion. And I would at least connect those two dots, and there might be more in that line.
Yeah.
That Lutheran Gnosticism that in a sense likes to put a dividing line when it is most convenient for me. When it means that I am off the hook, when it means that I don't have to exercise some sort of discipline, and whether it is, you know, sticking my neck out a little bit and saying, I think, you know, Proposition 5 or Title 17 or whatever it is, I think this is a bad choice, or whether it's the practice of saying, you know, young men of our congregation, we need you to be leaders, and I'll see you. We'll all get together at the park and we'll run, you know, 4 laps at 6:30 in the morning. I don't see any difference in all of that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So we returned last week from a mission trip out to the Dalles, about 90 miles east of Portland, Oregon, and
I think I remember that in Oregon Trail, like where you raft up Columbia River or something.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting too about the Dalles is I had just finished listening to and then watching the movie of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and that takes place in the Dalles, which I had never heard of before. And then, you know, God timed everything out, so I read and watched the movie, and then you read the book, watch the movie, and then go there. But we did a lot of walking because we canvassed about 250 homes every day. But before that, I had our mission team going hiking. And then before that, I would go walking with either my wife or my daughter. Like the one day, Belle and I did 3.5 miles. Then we went hiking. Then we went canvassing. So those were over 10 miles. But each day, and what, you know, I told people too, with all the hiking I try and do, the biking I do, is I don't want to be the fat pastor. You know, it's, you know, just to be humorous, but it's what you said too. Body and mind are together. We can't keep separating these things. And it's the same way with the way we deal with the two kingdoms. So, you know, I end that section there, just kind of calling out pastors, asking, where are the John the Baptists of today? You know, he called out the leaders. He called out King Herod. Why can't we do that? And I think a part of it too is we need to show love to our neighbor. Jesus teaches us that. That is the second of the two great commandments. Love God above all things and love your neighbor as yourself. We touched on this with the last episode with the Freedom Convoy and so forth, that sometimes we need to stand up for others when they can't stand up for themselves. And sometimes that might be pastors in the Bible study, pastors with his people, pastors from the pulpit, standing up for those who can't stand for themselves. Two stories with that, thinking of my daughters, that my one daughter, Miriam, you know, she was in the ROTC, you know, training for the Army while she was in college, and they were forcing her, like all the other military people, to get the COVID shot, and she refused to get it. And, you know, one of her superiors was just saying, why don't you just do this? And so she finally told him, sir, well, this bleeds into the next story, that my third daughter, Lydia, we encouraged her to do the Army ROTC. It would toughen her up, get her some leadership skills, help her pay for college like it did with Miriam. But then we saw everything that Miriam was going through and the rest of the military were going through. And then we told Lydia, who was a freshman in her first semester at school, and then in ROTC, we said, yeah, get out. Well, the colonel who was going to be overseeing Lydia called me, and I had met him, and he was trying to encouraged me to have Lydia stay in ROTC. And I told him, I said, these are the things that Miriam is going through. And this is, and I said, this is what Miriam told her commanding officer. And I said, sir, she said to her commanding officer, sir, we're supposed to protect those who can't protect themselves. We're supposed to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. We're to stand up for those who cannot stand for themselves. Who's standing up for me? Who's speaking for me? Who's protecting me? And, you know, the colonel was on the phone with me, and I knew he was a hard man, but I knew he wasn't going to yell at me. First, I'm a pastor, and secondly, he's trying to recruit my daughter. But he said, well, we're just following orders. And I said, sir, that is chicken. Again, he's not going to yell at me. I said, you can't just say I'm following
that
orders.
That is the Nuremberg defense. The Nuremberg defense does not work.
Yeah. And which is sad.
I like that.
That our own military leaders are using that terminology. But we can't just follow orders. We have to follow our Christian morality. And sometimes our Christian morality is going to say, I need to speak up because these people can't speak for themselves. And sometimes that's going to mean us as pastors being put in uncomfortable situations to say the kinds of very strong things that John the Baptist said.
Yeah. And I guess we talked about that, or at least I talked about that a little bit this past Sunday in our Bible class here. About the difference between policy and practice, because we were talking about church discipline. And policy would say that, you know, if you haven't been in church for 6 months, then you're removed from our membership. That would be like an example of a policy. But I said, you know what, we don't need another policy. Policies destroy churches and organizations and just make us legalists even more. What we need is proper spiritual practice. And so that practice, it takes time to talk with somebody, to see where they're coming from, to see what's going on in their lives. And you could have two people who have been absent from worship for 6 months, and one person, they would be in completely different scenarios. One person has been purposely avoiding it because they don't like fill in the blank. The other person has had health issues and then work schedules and then a funeral in the family and then required travel for work. And all of a sudden, 6 months have come by. The policy, the just following orders, would say these two are exactly the same because they have been absent for this period of time. Proper practice would say, well, these are two different cases, and we don't have to treat them the exact same way. We can, once we've diagnosed the condition of the heart, that this person is obstinate in their unbelief or persistent in their sin, then deal with that according to the law. And if this person is repentant and has a good heart, or, you know, really wants to be at church, for instance, then you deal with that differently. You say, hey, I'll come over and I'll bring you Holy Communion on Thursday, and you know, I'll keep doing that until you're able to make it. And it's the same way that at heart, you know, whether we are Lutheran Gnostics or whether we are just legalists, I'll tuck in all the inflammatory words, yeah, for your title today, Lutheran Gnostics or legalists, that we have a default setting that we prefer policy rather than a Lutheran practice, because then we don't have to think about it. And yeah, then we aren't sticking our neck out. And then it's not on me, that to do the work, to have the discipline, to follow through, to invest the heart and say, hey, I'm reaching out to another five members that I haven't seen this week. And even though some weeks it just feels like I'm just picking another fight, I do it because I care about these people and I want to approach it in a way that is loving and evangelical, because that is the proper practice, instead of falling back and say, well, we got a policy and here's what we're going to do.
Yeah, and when you're talking about that policy, that goes back to the earlier part of this chapter and an earlier podcast, that freedom is hard. So last question, and this is one I wrote just for you, Peter. Why were the
freedoms of the First Amendment?
Yeah, exactly. Why were the first two amendments of the U.S. Constitution written? Lobbing this one up to you to hit a home run. Why were the first two amendments written?
Oh, excellent question. Obviously, there's a little bit of history in the background, where there's a state church in England. But generally speaking, when you look at the amendments, we aren't looking at rights that the government grants. We are looking at rights of the people that the government cannot infringe upon, whether the amendment uses that terminology or not, that the government is not allowed to do these things. There are occasions where they say that it is allowable for them to do some of these things. But the bottom line is that the amendments are there to preserve the rights of the people, to preserve the structure of a free society so that the free exchange of ideas can happen and that that truth can be debated, discussed, and arrived at in public discourse rather than through the policy of laws.
Yeah, so the First Amendment is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So they're asked the question, what's the reason for the First Amendment? To protect citizens from an authoritarian regime that will limit citizens' speech, faith, associations, and more. That was, again, in that interview of Don Lemon of Elon Musk that I watched portions of it, so you don't have to. But, you know, Elon Musk was saying he, as the owner of X/Twitter, he doesn't have the right to do something illegal, which you see on the other social media platforms and so forth, of censoring, moderating, like Don Lemon wanted to say it's the same thing, censoring speech, that's illegal. It's against the First Commandment. And then the Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So why is that Second Amendment there, Peter?
Yeah, the Second Amendment, the positioning of the Second Amendment immediately after the first is usually, you know, colloquially said that the Second Amendment is there to protect the first.
Right.
Whether that happens in practice is a question that I hope never actually gets asked. But what we really see is that the rights begin with the individual, that the individual has the right to speech, and the individual also has the responsibility to be, you know, to be ready to use force in a way that is legal and godly.
And then, like you said, the Second Amendment is there to protect the first. That's the way I always say it too. And notice in nations where they do not have the Second Amendment, say like in England, which is very similar to us here in America, they don't have a right to bear arms. And notice how more and more of their speech is being taken away. And that speech, for example, of just standing outside of an abortion clinic and praying, even praying silently, you know, now they are policing thought. Well, you and I have talked numerous times about the thought police in 1984, George Orwell. That's the same thing. I don't know what it's like in Canada. Do they have a Second Amendment right? Do they have a right to bear arms?
Kind of.
Okay.
Not nearly as good.
Yeah.
Or as strong. I mean, you can get the privilege from the government as long as it's registered and all these things. And the interesting thing about it, there's been a lot of ink and articles and court cases, you know, large court cases related to the Second Amendment. And so that's an interesting overlap between when we're talking about firearms law as well as self-defense law, which is an entirely different avenue of law. So I've done a little bit of extra reading on that because it is a hot button topic for a lot of people. And the interesting thing, when you talk about speaking up for those who cannot speak for themselves, protecting those who cannot protect themselves, that when we're talking about a differential in power, that if the right of, you know, personal safety resides with the individual, then the responsibility also resides with the individual, that in a sense, the right to keep and bear arms is also, especially for those who are weakest in society. Like somebody who is, 60, 70, somewhat frail, would not stand a chance against somebody who's, in 20s and wants to mug that person, something like that. But that the Second Amendment provides a degree of those who are less physically capable to be able to stand up for themselves, to have a level playing field that, you know, they don't have to be able to have a roundhouse kick, but just to be able to squeeze a 6-pound trigger. Not that that's a particularly pleasant thing to talk about, and there would be legal ramifications for that. Let's not delude ourselves. It's a beautifully, you know, vast array of discussions related to that. But that where it really starts, the First Amendment is a personal right to speech and assembly and the press, association, and one more that's not coming to mind at the moment. And the Second Amendment is this personal right to be safe and secure in your person, even if there isn't a police officer walking with you 24/7.
Yeah. And, you know, I was reading a couple of articles the last few days in, you know, my news source, not to be, and they were talking about squatters. So these are people that move into your home and then they have these rights to this home. So there was one in New York State where this lady had, I think it was her parents' home. It was $1 million home and people just moved in and she doesn't have a right to move them out. She, in fact, was the one who was arrested. Then I read a follow-up article in Not the Bee about a guy, this was in California, they also have in the book squatters' rights. So he had lost his house to people that had just moved in. They moved in the furniture. He didn't have the right to change the locks, throw out their furniture, any of those things, even though it's his own house and the government won't help, the police won't do anything. So he found a way around the law. This would be resistance. That he watched the house until they were gone. Then he got in there with his friends. They threw out his furniture. They moved in his furniture. Then he changed the locks. And then he was able to get his mom to sign the lease over to him. So now he was the squatter and they didn't have rights. And so now what he does is he goes to help other people, say like the first person in the story in New York with $1 million house. And he will charge between $5,000 to $20,000 to help them figure out how to throw out the squatters and get their house back. And I bring it up here because this is, we have a right to our own property. But when the police and the local government will not help, sometimes then we have to take matters into our own hands. And that would be resistance. And I talk about this too in the middle of page 195 as we wrap this up here, talking about these two amendments, that these first two amendments legally and constitutionally give American citizens the right to practice civil disobedience to protect their freedoms as guaranteed by their U.S. Constitution. So many pastors consider it sinful and a refusal to submit to the government to practice civil disobedience. Then I ask this question. But how can it be sinful when citizens are submitting to their government's laws, which promote civil disobedience? Right. So we'll end with that question and we'll see you all at the next episode. All right. Lord's blessings on your celebration of Christ's death and resurrection with Holy Week.